What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
A rested child is a happy child. Sleep Tight Stories is a weekly podcast that brings comfort and joy to families worldwide with calming bedtime stories. The stories are relevant to children and spark wonder without overstimulation, so they can fall asleep and stay asleep. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. For a bedtime routine you'll miss when they're grown, Sleep Tight Stories.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're bringing you a classic episode of Invention. This is our episode on chopsticks. Is the show old enough to have classics? I think so.
Yeah. Either way, we are padding this podcast out. We are making it possible to put out some strong episodes in the new year and not have to scramble. And this is one that I really had a great time doing. One of the key sources for this that we'll discuss in the episode is a wonderful little book titled Chopsticks, A Cultural and Culinary History by Q. Edward Wang. I highly recommend checking that out if you are at all interested in Chinese culture, Chinese history, or just Chinese cuisine in general.
So this is our classic episode on chopsticks. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Invention, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Robert, do you hate as much as I do this stock scene from movies, TV shows, commercials, it's everywhere, of the standard clueless, clumsy Caucasian American guy trying to use chopsticks and dropping food all over the place, sometimes while a little like bloop-de-bloop cartoon music plays?
I don't think I've really witnessed it recently, so it's kind of fallen out of my mind to a certain extent. I tend to think of scenes from Blade Runner or something where the Harrison Ford character definitely has his chopstick skills down.
You know, it's not that I don't believe that there are adults in America who don't know how to use chopsticks. I'm sure there are. I mean, people have different levels of experience, and it's probably not easy the first time you do it.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they exist at the highest level of U.S. government.
But I just don't think that this is particularly hilarious, especially in, like, the 21st century. I mean, this was a scene we were seeing in TV shows in the 1980s. It's on par with the scene where somebody goes to a sushi restaurant and they're like, raw fish.
yeah, it seems like at this point you would be on board with sushi, or you would just not be in the sushi restaurant to begin with, and you would certainly be at least halfway competent with a pair of chopsticks.
Even if you're not competent, it's just a thing that you have to learn how to do. It's like watching people learn how to ride a bicycle. It's just not particularly funny. Mm-hmm. Why was this once a source of much cultural hilarity in the United States?
I imagine it was also pretty hilarious from the other perspective, too. Some bumbling Westerners trying to use this very precise method of manipulating food.
I have to admit that I love chopsticks in a kind of embarrassing and naive way. Like, one of my favorite things about eating several different kinds of Asian food is using chopsticks to eat them. I love like Chinese noodles with chopsticks. I love eating sushi with chopsticks, though sometimes I just eat sushi with my hands, as you often do.
It's acceptable, yeah.
Yeah. I love using chopsticks. I love it almost as much as I love the food itself. But I have found very strangely that I have a psychological block against using chopsticks on ethnic cuisines with which they do not originally pair. So I love using chopsticks and I want any excuse to use them, but I've tried to eat spaghetti with them, with like tomato basil sauce, and it does not work. It is psychologically revolting.
But this is all ridiculous when you start getting into the deeper history of any nation's cuisine. I mean, where do you think those noodles in spaghetti, in Italian spaghetti, came from?
Well, that's a good point.
They came from the East. Mm-hmm. They came from the land of chopsticks. And of course, one of the things we're going to get into in this episode is that, you know, there was a time before widespread chopstick usage in Asia. Mm-hmm. There was a time before widespread noodle and dumpling consumption in Asia. And it's all part of the history of how we eat our food and what we eat.
Right. So today's episode is going to be about chopstick technology.
Right. Everyone, I think, is familiar with chopsticks. We don't have to really explain these too much. But
there's two of them.
There's two of them.
They're sticks.
They're sticks. Use your manual dexterity to manipulate food with them. They may be made out of wood, bamboo, or they may be made out of metal or ceramic, plastic in some cases. But it's a pretty simple concept. And it does allow an amazing amount of precision. I remember at an early age, I was really impressed by chopsticks, in part because, we would go to little Chinese restaurants in the States. And when my family was living in Canada, one of my father's coworkers was a Chinese-Canadian physician, and he would use chopsticks, and he would let us use chopsticks. And there was a story he told when he was a child. If he misbehaved, his mother would dump a small bowl of uncooked rice out under the table, give him a pair of chopsticks, and then he would have to move each grain of rice with the chopsticks back into the bowl.
That is amazing, because that sounds like a punishment straight out of a fairy tale, doesn't it?
It does.
That's like a Cinderella type punishment.
But chopsticks, they are exactly the tool you would want to use to carry out this task. I mean, they're just so precise. They even beat human fingers in many instances, if not in precision, then at least in tact, right? Because it allows you because so much of our use of utensils, it's about how do you eat the food effectively, but also in a way that doesn't insult the people that you're eating with. Mm-hmm. Likewise, if you're eating hot food, which has been popular in human culture, it behooves you to be able to handle that food without burning your fingers, and chopsticks allow you to do that.
You know, when it comes to picking up individual grains of rice one at a time, I found out that there actually is a Guinness World Record category mm-hmm. for speed in picking up and eating individual grains of rice with chopsticks.
Oh, wow.
That's a thing you can compete in. So you can go the like number of hot dogs in a minute thing, or you can go the number of grains of rice in a minute thing. apparently the current holder of this world record is somebody named Silvio Saba in Milan, Italy, who was able to pick up and eat 25 individual grains of rice with chopsticks in 1 minute in February 2018, which actually that sounds kind of – I feel like that record could be beaten. I'm just imagining it.
And maybe so. Maybe you're the man to take up the chopsticks and give it a try.
I mean, surely you could get down to like a second and a half per rice grain, right?
I don't know. Who are we to doubt the Guinness Book of World Records though, Joe?
Yeah.
Now, one thing is certain though. When I'm using chopsticks, I often think about – I'm just always impressed. I'm like, these are great. And I do feel that temptation to want to use them on other foods. Mm-hmm. And really about the only foods that they don't make sense for so much are foods that require a great deal of cutting and carving. Mm. So I'm thinking like if you're eating a steak, you would need a knife. Now, I guess you could use a knife and chopsticks, and that would work. But for the most part, chopsticks are gonna get you there with just about any food.
You know, when you mentioned pairing a knife with chopsticks, there at least once was a product called fork and knife chopsticks. Have you seen this?
No.
There's like a a promo, obnoxious comedy promo video that used to go around the internet. Actually, it was a video where hilarity ensues when some Caucasian gentleman is trying to eat something with chopsticks. He just keeps dropping it all over himself, and it's like, oh, there's got to be a better way. And the better way is that the other side of these chopsticks are a fork and a knife.
Oh, so you can flip them around. See, at first I thought you meant that you're using them like chopsticks, but then it has a tiny fork and a tiny knife on the end. But this is just, you flip them around. Okay.
No, yeah, so it's stick party in front, fork and knife business in back. And actually, okay, they would sort of hook together to make hinged chopsticks, which are not exactly traditional chopsticks.
Okay, well, that's not the worst invention, I suppose.
No, the promo video is really obnoxious, but the invention is fine, though it looks like it's been discontinued, or at least from the original seller, as far as I could tell.
Chopsticks themselves, however, of course, are still very much in production. They have not been discontinued. There is no sign of chopsticks going away anytime soon.
In fact, I think I read about a problem with billions of disposable chopsticks being used every year.
Yeah. If anything, the big take home is if you like using chopsticks, if you find yourself regularly using chopsticks, invest in a set of chopsticks, a mobile set that you can carry around and use at home, and cut down on the disposable chopsticks.
Now, where did chopsticks come from?
Well, they came from China, and as we were talking about with our researcher for this program, Scott Benjamin, they popped up prior to 1200 BCE, though some sources say they've been around for nearly 9,000 years. But this is as cooking utensils, a way of moving ingredients around in a hot wok, for instance. But when it comes to the use of chopsticks at the dinner table, or as a means of bringing food to your mouth, sometimes you see it stated that we're really looking at more 400 CE as kind of a rough, very rough time stamp for when it really began to become more popular and began to spread culturally the idea that these are utensils that should be used to consume food as well. Now, as we'll get into, this is not a super firm timestamp. It's not like you will not find people eating with chopsticks before that point, but this seems to be where the levee really breaks on the idea.
People do like to come up with origin stories for things, though, mm-hmm. even when there isn't a clear origin story.
Well, that's often part of the fun, right? Is that there's not an actual inventor, but there's a mythic character that had some sort of role in the invention, some sort of cultural hero who stole fire from the gods, etc.
Exactly. So we were both looking at a book. Robert, I think you actually read the whole book.
Yeah, it's a short read, actually, something like 200 and something pages.
It's a book by Q. Edward Wang that is called Chopsticks, A Cultural and Culinary History, published in 2015 from Cambridge University Press. And Wang points out that a common Chinese legend tells the story of how chopsticks were first invented by Da Yu, founder of the Xia dynasty, which ruled from 2100 to 1600 BCE. And I've poked around for a couple of versions of this legend. Basically, the story goes like this. Da Yu was the figure credited with fighting the great flood of Chinese history and mythology by the use of dredging in the riverbeds and construction of irrigation canals to divert water flow. Now, Robert, you've talked about the Chinese Great Flood legends on podcasts before.
Yeah, and Yu definitely comes up in that episode because he's a true cultural hero in Chinese mythology. And the if I am remembering correctly, the knowledge to overcome the flood was actually stolen or obtained from the gods, I think by Yu's father. And then Yu himself is the one who really brings it to the people.
I think that's correct. But so Yu eventually succeeds in defeating the Great Flood, and this made him emperor and founder of the Xia dynasty. But there are lots of stories and legends about how much he sacrificed personally and how tirelessly he worked on this project to defeat the floodwaters. And one of these legends is that Da Yu had at one point had some meat sizzling in a wok, mm-hmm. but he was in such a hurry to fight the flood that he couldn't sit there and wait for the meat to cool down enough to handle and eat. So he got a pair of twigs and he used them to pick up the hot pieces of meat and hurry along his meal so he could get back to work.
Ah.
But clearly, this is just a legend.
But still, there it does illustrate like the basic clever idea, the novelty of using just some twigs, some sticks, but using them, using just found objects, but using them in an inventive way that changes the way you do things. And this is likely exactly how chopsticks emerged in just the darkness of prehistory, is the use of found twigs. Maybe the twigs have been manipulated in some fashion, but for the most part, just a couple of found sticks that are used to manipulate food inside of a cooking pot, or also the use of fire sticks, which would just be chopsticks that are used for moving, burning wood or coal around.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that I think is interesting about chopsticks that is different from the use of, say, a fork or a knife, or even, I mean, sort of like a spoon, but also somewhat different from a spoon, is that chopsticks, in a way, function sort of like extensions of the fingers.
Yeah.
You know, they do a similar pinching action that you can do with your thumb and index finger.
Mm-hmm.
But they, you know, they extend the fingers farther. They can handle hot stuff without getting grease on the fingers and all that. They can reach into soup and pull out noodles. They can do all that kind of stuff. But they, in a way, feel like a more natural extension of the pinching, grasping action of the skeleton itself.
Mm-hmm.
They feel like more like they emerge out of the schema of the human body than, say, a knife, which, you know, you don't have a knife and you don't have any sharp fingers. You don't have a fork, really. There's no stabbing sharp tines on your hand. There's just nothing analogous to a knife and a fork on your body.
Yeah, I mean, this makes me realize that, and granted, I definitely use fork and knife more than I use chopsticks, and I am not by any means an expert practitioner with chopsticks, but I do feel like I am far more likely to bumble and drop a fork, knife, or spoon than I am to bumble and drop my chopsticks. Like, the chopsticks, to your point, are just more an extension of your body when you're using them.
Now, obviously, if you're looking for ancient artifacts, ancient evidence of chopsticks, just standard twigs aren't going to stick around very well, right? So you'd be looking probably for chopsticks or indications that chopsticks were made out of other materials.
Right. So for instance, you will find like bronze chopsticks or what are believed to be chopsticks in the tombs at the ruins of Yin in Henan province in central China. Because essentially what we're talking about here is a Neolithic invention. Like you say, the twigs are not going to stick around. There is evidence that suggests 5,000 BCE is a possibility for early archaeological evidence of chopsticks. Though I've also read that some of these bone sticks from this time and earlier may also be interpreted as hairpins or tools of another sort.
But this is often a problem with Neolithic technology is it's not quite so clear what you're really looking at.
It might
be clear that an artifact is not naturally occurring, mm-hmm. And it was shaped in some way, but what was it used for? Not always clear.
Because this is ultimately one of the confounding things about chopsticks is that it is a relatively simple concept. You don't need anything beyond Neolithic technology to pull it off, and yet you don't see it emerging independently in other cultures. You just don't see it taking off everywhere. But it is it's a cultural difference. And you see similar cultural differences in tool use among chimpanzees, for instance. Nothing so grand as chopstick usage. You will not find chimpanzees inventing the chopsticks. But you will see a similar situation in things that are unessential behavior. Mm-hmm. You do not have to invent the chopstick in order to eat and survive and develop all the other technologies that that a culture may develop. But it is curious how we see the chopsticks emerge in China and spread out from China, but they don't independently emerge elsewhere.
Now, as far as evidence that twigs were commonly used, just, you know, snapped off branches and twigs were commonly used for chopsticks, Wang in his book cites literary evidence from the ancient world that it was a common practice by, say, the 3rd or 4th century BCE to snap pieces off of the lower branches of a tree and use them for chopsticks. And for example, he cites a passage from Junzi, who lived 340 to 245 BCE. And Junzi says this in service of illustrating an unrelated point. So he's just like sort of using an analogy here. But he says, If you look up at a forest from the foot of a hill, the bigger trees appear no taller than chopsticks, and yet no one hoping to find chopsticks is likely to go picking among them. It is simply that the height obscures their natural dimensions. So he's not really talking about chopsticks in this passage, but it just sort of makes passing reference to the fact that you might go, quote, picking chopsticks.
So it becomes difficult to really like nail down when people started using chopsticks in cooking. So we have in this an ancient tool, an ancient utensil for the preparation of food. The question then is, how does it really leave the kitchen? How does it go from being just something that you use in the production of food to becoming the primary means of consuming said food? Because, for instance, many of us use a ladle in the kitchen, you know, or one of those, you know, those deep-seated spoons that are just for ladling out soup. You probably don't use one at the dinner table. You probably don't use it to drink soup.
I eat with a spider strainer.
but that's another example, yeah. You could technically do it, but you probably don't. Speaking of spoons and soup, though, Wang gets into this, and he points out that the spoon was actually the most important eating implement for people in ancient East and Southeast Asia.
I can see that. I mean, the spoon is going to be common to pretty much every culture, right? Because it is essentially just a retaining receptacle.
Yeah.
I mean, it can move pretty much any kind of food. You could eat steak with a spoon.
Right. Yeah. If given the choice between a fork and a spoon, I rarely pick the fork.
Right.
I don't eat a lot of food that requires a stabbing fork anymore, so I'm more than happy with the spoon. Just give me the spoon. I don't even want to look at the fork. Anything I can do with the fork, I can probably do with the spoon. And then, of course, I can do it even better with the chopsticks. But the spoon was the most important eating implement for people in ancient East and Southeast Asia, and this is backed up by both archaeological and textual accounts. And there are many reasons. Some of these we've just hit on here, just the ultimate practicality of the spoon. But something else that Wang points out is that from antiquity up to the 10th century, millet was the dominant grain cereal in North China, Korea, and parts of Japan. And this particular substance is best cooked into a thick gruel that demands the attention of spoons rather than any other form of utensil.
So yeah, try to imagine eating like oatmeal with chopsticks. You could do it. It's just not the best thing to use.
Right. And you might say, well, what's the difference? How about rice? How's rice different? Well, rice clumps up.
Yeah, rice is different. I mean, if you are eating rice that you cannot eat with chopsticks, you're probably eating the wrong rice.
Right.
Well, that's not necessarily true. I mean, so like sometimes basmati rice, which is wonderful, doesn't clump together the same way like a jasmine rice would. But yeah, I guess what I had in mind when I was insulting rice was like parboiled rice, which maintains very distinct individual grains and is
meh. Yeah, right. And boiling is key here because this was the age of boiling. Stews and soups, this is what you ate. Chopsticks, they crept in as merely a supporting utensil that you might use to like stir around the depths to grab a few things out of the depths of your soup or stew. But for the most part, you're going to have to depend on that spoon. By the 10th century, Wang writes, wheat becomes the primary grain.
Hmm.
And so you get wheat noodles, you get wheat dumplings, and then chopsticks become extremely important because these make it far easier to manipulate those noodles or dumplings. If you've ever tried to eat, especially noodles with a spoon, but even a dumpling can become a complete comedy of errors because a dumpling can tend to be a little slippery and you're trying to like balance it on the spoon. No, you're better off grabbing it with the chopsticks. And then from the 11th century onward, he writes that rice, of course, becomes increasingly popular. And since rice clumps, chopsticks can be used to great effect with them. Oh, yeah. And then in terms of boiling, well, by the 3rd century, he writes that by this point, you had cooking oils, thanks to the millstone that allows you to break down the various seeds and whatnot that you're using to create that frying oil. So, yeah, you don't have to boil all of your ingredients. You can fry them. And this means more reliance on bite-sized ingredients rather than, giant, bones and meat that are dropped in with your vegetables for the stew.
Yeah, and though, of course, not all, say, Chinese cooking is the stir fries we're familiar with or whatever, that is one common feature of many Chinese recipes is things, not a big hunk of meat on the plate, but things sliced into bite-sized pieces.
And the other thing about bite-sized pieces is that they cook faster.
Yeah.
They require less fuel. This becomes more and more important, many commentators touch upon, as fuel becomes an issue.
Right. In Chinese civilization, there were points where suddenly, like, firewood is mm-hmm. more expensive, harder to come by.
Yeah. So what are you going to cook? Are you going to cook a giant slab of meat, or are you going to cook little slivers of meat? That have been prepared, of course, in the kitchen, and then fried up, and you can manipulate them with your chopsticks while they're cooking. And then, of course, when it comes time to eat, it is also the perfect implement to employ. Wang also points out that in pre-modern times, chopsticks also cut down on the risk of germs in communal eating.
Oh, that's a good point.
Which is an interesting point.
So, yeah, if people are, say, picking dumplings out of a shared dish, you don't have to reach in there with your dirty hands. You can pluck them out precisely with chopsticks.
Now, it's important to note in all of this that, we can't simply say that people created chopsticks in this age or that they began to actually eat with them in another age. There's a lot of gradual change going on here, and there are some notable ancient accounts or legends or myths, what have you, of eating with chopsticks. And that's where we have to discuss the lavish lifestyle of King Zhou of the Shang Dynasty. He would have lived 1075 through 1046 BCE.
Okay, take me there. Take me to this ancient binge.
All right, so he established somewhat of a reputation. He's best remembered as, what's the term?
Party animal?
Yeah, definitely a party animal. A real...
a Bluto?
A real Bluto. Yeah, he loved his food. He loved the flesh, and so we have to keep that in mind. That, like, how much of this is accurate? How much of this is an actual ruler who had a decadent lifestyle? And how much of this is, of course, just attributed to somebody who fell out of the good graces of history?
But so okay, if he's a party animal, does he party with chopsticks?
He does. He was said to have always eaten with an ornate pair of ivory chopsticks.
Whoa.
And he wouldn't, it was strongly stressed that he wouldn't eat out of just earthenware bowls like the rest of the people. No, he would only eat from bowls of jade and rhino horn.
Oh, rhino horn. Now, we've talked before on a different show on Stuff to Blow Your Mind about ancient beliefs concerning the powers of the rhino horn, especially as it concerned people who were concerned with being poisoned like royalty.
Right. Yeah. And then jade, of course, also has magical properties in Chinese tradition. So it makes sense that he would only eat from these, because they would have been reputed to have some sort of focus on food purification and poison prevention. And ivory chopsticks would later go on to become a symbol of decadent life and corrupt politics. But it went far beyond that with King Zhou. He's said to have had his own, quote, alcohol pool and meat forest.
They stole the name of my restaurant. I can't open it now.
It does remind me of some of these more decadent steak restaurants, you know, where they bring around like skewers of meat. Mm-hmm. Because this is described as essentially a lake of wine. And you would boat around in it, you know, with your concubines and your pals. And as you're boating around, drinking from the wine lake, you would also pluck cuts of meat from the roasting pillars that are around you like a forest.
This is like a satanic Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
It is. You know,
it's this like unholy version of the chocolate rivers.
He is also said to have delighted in eating, quote, the meat of long-haired buffaloes and unborn leopards.
I have no comment on that.
Well, it's a decadent diet to have, you know, only the weirdest and the strangest. It's like Monty Burns on The Simpsons wanting to wear the pelts of various exotic and endangered animals.
Oh, yeah. See my vest.
Yes, yes.
Chopstick etiquette time. We just got to have that jump in and invade whatever we were talking about.
Right. It will probably upset most people if you're eating unborn leopards, but also a point of etiquette here, never point your chopsticks at someone.
Really?
Yeah. Like if you're, you know, brandishing them at the table, you know, keep the direction down toward the food. That's generally advised. And also, never stick your chopsticks upright in a bowl of rice, as this is a portent of death.
Yes, I've heard that this is because chopsticks set upright in a bowl of rice can resemble sticks of incense or chopsticks that are set upright in rice in funeral ceremonies.
Oh, this makes sense. This is something that would be very easy to miss for, say, a Westerner traveling in China, which is why you see it cited in a lot of travel books. Do not do this. This is an easy thing that you cannot do and save yourself some grief.
I always wonder about that kind of stuff when you see etiquette cited in books for travelers. It's mm-hmm. like, is this a real rule or not? I feel like when you read those things, you've got to be reading some real common etiquette guidelines mixed in with things that people just made up.
Well, I guess it depends on the faux pas they're warning you against. Because some of them are more widespread and more central to a given culture. Like I instantly think of various taboos concerning shoes in Thailand. If you're seated so that your shoes are pointed against somebody, or certainly any kind of situation where your shoes are placed, say, in a bin at an airport with other belongings. But we need to save that for our episode on the invention of shoes. At this point, we should probably take a break. And when we come back, we are going to discuss even more about the invention of chopsticks and just the spread of this cultural idea that this is how one should eat one's food.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron.
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide. The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart. Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day. Sleep Tight Stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on StoryButton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Robert, divulge to me the wisdom of the great Confucius as it concerns utensil etiquette.
Yes, this is interesting because this is where we find the connection between the great Chinese teacher, politician, and philosopher Confucius. And chopsticks. Interestingly enough, I was just watching, I just finally began to watch Michael Wood's The Story of China, which is a fabulous documentary. He's done a couple of these before, one on India, one on England, and some other documentary features as well. But this is like a, I want to say it's like an 8-part documentary look at the history of China mm-hmm. and Chinese culture. And it's really good. You can find it on, I think, Amazon Prime currently, and it's also on PBS in America. But the first episode does a wonderful job of breaking it down just how political core Confucian teachings really were, governing the about how, you know, you govern the moral character of a people via the ruler. So the ruler and his morals, they're the wind to the people's field of grass, dictating the nature of the people.
Oh, you know, I feel like our modern Western sensibility is kind of – well, actually, they're pushing me both ways on that.
Mm-hmm.
Because on one hand, there's this very American tradition that says, you know, oh, we don't let leaders define us. We say what the leaders should be. But then on the other hand, I think I've read that there is some pretty – recent research in political science finding that very often people's opinions about subjects that are controversial in politics are mostly shaped by what their leaders believe. There are a few issues that people have firm opinions on. Most things, they just believe what the people they have designated their leaders in their cultural in-group elites say.
Yeah, I think this lines up rather well with Confucian ideas. Now, Confucius lived 551 through 479 BCE, a time during which we see the emergence of so many new ideas concerning human culture and the human condition. He's known outside of China as Confucius because this is the Latinization of Kong Fuzi, a.k.a. Master Kong.
Hmm.
And we can hardly summarize his teachings here on the show, but he believed that through study, morality and virtue could win out over violence and tyranny. Ruling by example is better than ruling by law and punishment alone. His teachings, however, would only come to widely influence Chinese rule and culture after his death. But his teachings did spread, and it seems so too did his ideas on eating utensils. He championed blunt chopsticks over the use of knives and is quoted as having believed that, quote, the honorable and upright man keeps well away from both the slaughterhouse and the kitchen, and he allows no knives at his table. Now, it's unknown to what extent this impacted the actual use of meat in Chinese cuisine, but perhaps due in part as well to Buddhist influence. One sees meat used more for flavor, flavoring, you know, the broth, flavoring vegetables by around the first century.
This is really interesting because the thoughts of Confucius here actually remind me of something I read years ago about mm-hmm. chopsticks that has been lodged in my brain ever since. And I think it might be part of my love relationship with chopsticks, why I'm always looking for an excuse to use them. They feel morally good to me.
Yeah.
Like something about using chopsticks isn't just aesthetically pleasing. It feels virtuous. I know that sounds quite silly, but I think one origin of this association in my mind is that when I was in college, I read a book called Empire of Signs by the French critic and semiotician Roland Barthes. It was first published in 1970 and then in English translation by Richard Howard in the early 1980s. And it's kind of a semiotic travelogue of Japan. And I don't think I'd actually vouch for Barthes as a very good observer of other cultures in general, even for his time. And I think you could argue that there are traces of kind of Orientalism in his thoughts mm-hmm. About Asia. Apparently, he was somewhat dismissive of the value of studying Chinese culture. But I read this book many years ago, and Barthes' thoughts about chopsticks always stuck with me as kind of more interesting and more thoughtful than a lot of the rest, as kind of more interesting and perhaps more valid than a lot of the rest. So here's some of what he says about chopsticks. And this is abridged selections from his book Empire of Signs. Quote, the instrument never pierces, cuts, or slits, never wounds, but only selects, turns, shifts. For the chopsticks, in order to divide, must separate, part, peck, instead of cutting and piercing, in the manner of our implements. They never violate the foodstuff. Either they gradually unravel it in the case of vegetables, or else prod it into separate pieces in the case of fish, eels, thereby rediscovering the natural fissures of the substance.
Huh.
He also writes, by chopsticks, food becomes no longer a prey to which one does violence, meat, flesh over which one does battle, but a substance harmoniously transferred. And then he says, finally, of people who use chopsticks to eat, maternal, they tirelessly perform the gesture which creates the mouthful, leaving to our alimentary manners, armed with pikes and knives, that of predation.
Oh, well, that's beautiful.
I like that comparison. It somehow rings true to me. I mean, it may be an overgeneralization of the differences between the two eating cultures. You know, Europeans, fork and knife culture on one hand, and Japanese chopstick culture on the other hand. But I really feel like there's something to what he's saying about the fact that when eating with chopsticks, one does not make artificial cuts in the meat or in the food in general as it is presented to you. It's, you know, it may have been cut already in the preparation, but any separations of the foodstuffs happen along natural lines of separation. So I can think about, like, if you have a, you know, a stir-fried little head of baby bok choy on your plate and you're eating with chopsticks, the leaves come away whole as you peel them off. Or yeah, the fish flakes along the natural lines of its muscles.
I have to say, with bok choy, I'm more inclined to try and grab the whole thing with the chopsticks and shove it into my mouth, which is, I think, an important point to make here. We talk a lot about the precision of the chopsticks and maybe the brutal aspects of fork, knife, and spoon. But we do need to remind everyone that you can still eat like an utter slob while using chopsticks. It's well within within range for human behavior.
Oh yeah, I would often say even when you observe Chinese people eating, they often will say bring the bowl up to near their face as they eat with chopsticks, and there's kind of like this beautiful shoveling action.
Yeah,
that I think. I think it might be a sort of I don't know what's actually etiquette and what's not. I mean, I feel like Western tradition would say you don't hold the bowl up near your face.
Well, this gets into two. Sometimes you hear it put forth that it's okay to slurp, like slurping the soup in certain Eastern traditions is a compliment to the chef, that sort of thing. I actually did have the experience once of getting noodles at a Chinese noodle shop in this was in Honolulu, I think. So it was predominantly Chinese clientele, and I was trying to eat consume the noodles you know, carefully, and there was actually an older woman there, a Chinese woman, who turned to me and basically let me know it's okay to slurp, it's okay to bring the bowl up to your face, like this is all right.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to Confucius and DeBarth. In both cases, there's this idea that the method we use to get food from the plate into our mouths does have some kind of psychological conditioning effect. And I can't cite research to say that this is definitely true, but it certainly feels true. At least it seems to make plausible sense, and I feel it myself when I'm eating. I feel a different kind of effect on my mind when I eat with chopsticks versus when I cut with a fork and knife.
On some level, anytime I'm using a fork and knife to eat, I am picturing like a scene from a medieval motion picture, a motion picture set in medieval times, not one made during the Middle Ages, obviously. But, you know, some scene of some brutal lord carving up his food while hounds feast on the bones beneath the table.
Right.
Like I'm somehow employing that scene in my mind, but both negatively but also positively, because there's something kind of awesome about that scenario too. And then when I eat with chopsticks, there is something bird-like. Like I'm on some level, I'm imagining that I am being fed by a bird puppet.
Well, for me, fork and knife feels more mechanical, artificial, and architectural, and chopsticks feel more organic and related to the forms of the natural world. Again, they are more like the extensions of your skeleton.
Yeah.
But it also, as we were saying, coincides with differences in common preparation methods in, say, many European traditions of cooking versus East Asian traditions of cooking, where very often, though not always, very often in, say, Chinese cooking, ingredients are sliced or cut up in advance.
Yeah, and in this we come back to that idea that scarce resources and a growing population in China demanded that smaller portions of food be cooked faster over less fuel. Thus, chopsticks are an ideal way to consume the finished dish as well.
Yeah.
Though one of the points that Wang makes in his book is that, you know, technically, you know, certainly there are a number of key advantages to cooking food. Mm-hmm. We've touched on that on Stuff to Blow Your Mind before. It is the externalization of digestion in many respects. But at the same time, do you have to eat it hot? Can't you just wait until it's room temperature again and then you can eat it with your fingers? We often insist on eating it hot. We end up preferring warm or hot food.
Mm-hmm. I think there's some research on why we prefer hot food, right? Is there?
Well, that sounds like something we should save for a future episode on the invention of the hot bar. But in terms of like eating with your fingers, though, Wang summarizes in his book, again, Chopsticks, A Cultural and Culinary History, that we see the shift from fingers to utensils between 500 and 1000 BCE. And then we see spoons and chopsticks used as an established set of eating tools in China between 300 and 600 CE. So at this is the point where it becomes clear that if you're going to eat, you're probably going to need that spoon because there are going to continue to be soups and broths and whatnot. But on the other side of the plate, you're going to want those chopsticks because that is going to be how you're going to consume all of these finer pieces.
Yeah, chopsticks and spoon. They are the buddy cop movie of my mouth.
All right, we're going to take one more break. And when we come back, we're going to discuss the legacy of chopsticks.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me!
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on StoryButton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. And I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
All right, we're back.
Okay, Robert, we mentioned a little bit about random bits of chopsticks etiquette before. One thing we should point out is that there are definitely some regional variations on chopstick etiquette. You know, the rules aren't the same everywhere you go. But some common examples that I've found reading about chopstick etiquette around the world would be one big one is you don't stab food with the tip of chopsticks.
Oh,
apparently,
yes.
That is just – that's not cool.
Yeah, that's one you have to really break down for a child. When my own son was learning how to use chopsticks, I mean, that's you want to use them like the adults are using them, but it's difficult at first. And the first thing that comes to their mind is, well, I can just use this to stab my dumplings instead.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to say, no, do not stab the dumplings with that stick.
It's like licking a knife. You just, you know, it just looks it looks brutal and weird.
Yeah, except when Dracula does it. You know, when Gary Oldman licks the razor blade?
Oh, Gary Oldman can make anything look cool. But hey, here's another one. I read this in several places, and I wonder how common this rule of etiquette actually is. But what I have read in several places is something about Chinese chopstick etiquette. And it chilled me because I know I've violated this. I have done it. You know how sometimes you're eating a good bowl of some kind of stir-fried delight? Maybe it's some kind of noodle dish or some fried rice or just some kind of stir-fry. And you might be searching around in your dish for that one delicious thing, that big piece of black fungus or that one last shrimp or something like that. Apparently, digging around with chopsticks in search of something can be seen as bad manners and is something referred to as, quote, grave digging or digging your grave.
Huh. Well, on one hand, this seems like it's a rule against overutilizing the freedom of the utensil.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it also makes sense if you're thinking about a more communal eating scenario,
right,
where you're sharing one big bowl or one hot pot, etc. It's cheating for you to go digging around and getting all the choice pieces of protein out before anyone else can have a shot at them.
Exactly. And also, I don't know if this is the reason, but I have to wonder if part of it is that it could be considered insulting to the host or the cook, right? Implying that the dish only has a limited amount of the good stuff and there's not enough of it and you want to dig around to find all of that.
Again, it's the very thing you warn a child not to do. Don't just eat the shrimp. Eat the vegetables too.
Mm-hmm. For the child's own good, but also so as not to insult the host, right?
Right.
Because if you're just digging out the shrimp, the implication is, why didn't you just give me a bowl full of shrimp?
Well, that makes sense. This makes sense as well. But also another piece of etiquette that we can all take with us. Because sometimes it is hard to resist. If again, for that choice delicious shrimp in there in the noodles.
Well, I find myself maybe this is bad manners in general, but I find myself when using chopsticks, especially just trying to compose perfect little mouthfuls of things. Like I want to get everything lined up together, like a little bit of the carbohydrate element, a little bit of the vegetable, a little bit of the meat or whatever, and have that all just arranged just right before I shovel.
Oh, yeah. And then if you're like me, you run the risk of it slipping because you're trying to treat – this is my possible interpretation here – is that sometimes we try and treat the chopsticks as a fork. Because with a fork, yeah, you can just go stab, 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 and you get your little taste sensation of four different elements lined up.
The one-bite buffet.
Right. But with chopsticks, sometimes when I try and do that – it can be an act of folly because ultimately maybe I should be eating it piece by piece in a more chopsticks friendly manner.
You know, one thing I've noticed when I watch a decent amount of cooking videos with actual chefs in the Asian tradition, so like Japanese chefs, Chinese chefs. And a lot of times I see them using chopsticks still in cooking. We mentioned that they originally played a big role in cooking, but I see this still happening. They're like chopsticks used in a wok, chopsticks used for, say, tempura frying.
Yeah, and then you'll also see with modern, gourmet chefs, anyone who's ever watched, some sort of a Netflix cooking show has seen these gourmet chefs using tweezers, but in some cases chopsticks, to carefully align the food on the plate and make sure everything's positioned just right. That's essentially the same principle. I mean, what are tweezers but less proper chopsticks.
Have you ever seen our coworker Dylan Fagan eating Cheetos out of a bag with chopsticks?
No, I haven't noticed this.
Genius.
Yes.
Doesn't get any Cheeto dust on his fingers. He'll have the little bag there and he's going at it with chopsticks and it's so cute.
And I think it's culturally appropriate because Cheetos are a snack with no nation. They're completely honorless. So it's okay to use chopsticks. If anything, you run the risk of offending chopsticks.
Now, a big part of chopstick culture in the world today is that we've got tons of disposable chopsticks. Disposable chopsticks are being used all the time. And I am a big fan of reusable chopsticks. But I also admit I frequently use the disposable ones and feel bad about how many I've probably sent to the landfill in my lifetime.
Yeah, some of the research that was provided for us from Scott Benjamin on this, he points out that disposable sets, typically bamboo, weren't really created until the 1800s. And this was largely a Japanese creation. And today, disposable chopsticks are a bit of a problem. In Japan alone, around 24 billion pairs are used each year, about 200 pairs per person each year.
That's a lot of waste.
Yeah. But then again, lest Western listeners be too judgmental on this fact, I just remind everyone to think about your disposable straw usage.
Yep.
Think about your disposable fork, knife, spoon, and spork usage.
Mm-hmm.
I think these are all part of the same problem.
Oh, absolutely. No reason to single out Japan here.
Now, speaking of Japan, it's also pointed out that chopsticks were historically longer for men and shorter for women, 8 inches for men, 7 inches for women. And the actual size of chopsticks varies now, and it seems that there's no standard length for any one country. Another pro-chopsticks fact, the blunt shape of chopsticks also makes them easier on lacquer-covered ornate cookware. Again, you're not going to be stabbing and slicing with fork and knife on it. You're going to be more politely poking at them with pieces of wood or, in some cases, of course, pieces of metal.
Hmm.
Now, speaking of the materials used in chopsticks, in Korea, metal chopsticks have become the standard. But you'll also find various other substances, both currently and in the past, bamboo, plastic, wood, bone, stainless steel, as well as for the wealthy, titanium, gold, silver, again, porcelain, jade, ivory.
Gold chopsticks? What?
Yeah. And it's also was once believed that chopsticks made of silver would corrode and turn black if the food was poisoned.
Oh, so this sounds like it's along the lines of the rhino horn and mm-hmm. jade.
However, of course, this is not true. Silver will not react to arsenic or cyanide, but it will react to garlic, onions, and rotten eggs. these are all things that produce hydrogen sulfide, which does turn silver black. Now, a few other little tidbits about chopstick use. Wang points out in his book that you had the chopstick diet. Japanese English author Kimiko Barber argued in her 2009 book, The Chopsticks Diet, that using chopsticks is healthier because it forces you to slow down and savor and think about your food.
I don't know if it's actually healthier, but it does certainly force me to slow down and savor food more. Yeah.
Again, it's presented. Wang presented it as something to think about, not necessarily fact. He also points out, in fact, he points out several times this idea of the chopsticks cultural sphere. This was a term coined by Japanese writer Ishiki Hashiro. And he argued that chopsticks require enhanced brain coordination and that this improves not only dexterity but also brain development, especially in children. Now, Wang's points out that scientists have produced, quote, positive results on both fronts, but that also lifetime chopsticks use might result in higher risk for osteoarthritis in hand joints among the elderly. More work is required in both areas, though, and perhaps this is something that we could follow up with on Stuff to Blow Your Mind in the future.
Yes, I'd definitely be interested in that, especially given what we talked about earlier, that at least firsthand experience really makes me feel like chopsticks are doing something to my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like something different is happening to my mind when I use them as opposed to fork and knife. Now, chopsticks also show up in another interesting place in a now semi-famous paper that is about the dangers of not understanding your sample correctly if you're a scientist and you're doing something like genetics testing. And it's a principle known as population stratification or population admixture that was discussed in a 2000 paper by Hamer and Sirota called Beware the Chopsticks Gene in the Nature publication Molecular Psychiatry. Now, the authors of this paper tell a story to illustrate how scientists can possibly be misled in genetics research if they're not careful. And the story goes like this. So, Robert, once upon a time, there was an ethnogeneticist who was looking for a subject to study. And he decided he would like to figure out why certain people eat with chopsticks and others don't. So he rounded up a few hundred university students and he gave them questionnaires to find out how often they use chopsticks. And then he took cheek swabs to get DNA samples from each of them. So his lab ran DNA analysis and cross-referenced the responses to the questionnaire with the DNA and found a huge correlation between one particular genetic marker right in the middle of a region previously linked to other behavioral traits and the use of chopsticks. And so then this experiment was replicated. It was performed at several other universities, and they all got the same result. So the original ethnogeneticist, he celebrates, he decides it's time to call up the media and tell them, I've found the chopsticks gene. It is a gene that makes people prone to eat with chopsticks.
And this, again, is correlation. And as we frequently point out, is that one of the golden rules of science is that correlation is not necessarily causation.
Right. Anything that is causation should be correlated, but there are lots of things that are correlated that don't have a causal relationship with each other. And this could very well be one of those examples, because in this story, unfortunately, the geneticist discovers only several years later that this particular gene is actually a histocompatibility antigen gene that has nothing to do with dining utensils, but it just happens to be an allele that's more common in people with recent Asian ancestry than with other ethnic groups. So the point is to illustrate that you could find a gene associated with a trait. The level of statistical correlation can be highly significant, and the test can be replicated many times, and it's still possible that your results are biologically meaningless. This gene has nothing to do with how you use your hands or what kind of utensils you favor. It happens to be more common in a population who uses chopsticks more often for cultural reasons. It's a complete accident of culture, and it highlights a general problem with studying populations. If you don't understand and consider the population you're studying, it's possible to draw spurious correlations. Using similar naive logic, you could probably find a French accent gene or a support for Russia's World Cup team gene.
You know, this does remind me of an early experience taking my son to a Chinese restaurant. My wife and I were there with him, and he did not know how to use chopsticks at the time. He's 6 years old and uses them extremely well. But when we first took him to this Chinese restaurant, the owner of the restaurant came around. And he was saying hi, and of course he noted that that my son is ethnically Han Chinese, and he pointed out to us, don't let him use the cheating chopsticks, you know, ones where you take a rubber band or a hinge. He says, don't let him use those. Let him just figure it out because he has it in his DNA.
Well, that's kind of a sweet story. But yeah, it operates on exactly the same principle, assuming that things that are actually just accidents of culture and history are somehow in the body, that there's something in the body that makes you that way.
Right. When really it is just it is cultural information. It's cultural knowledge that is passed on. And in the case of learning how to use chopsticks, I will say that his advice was, I think, act completely sound. My son learned to use chopsticks not by cheating and using some sort of rubber band and a piece of paper rolled up. He used them by watching adults use them, imitating what they were doing, using them, you know, poorly for a while, and then using them with competence.
As an adult, I'm pretty good with chopsticks, but I did start using them at a slightly later age. I wonder if I'd started using them at an earlier age when I still had that neuroplasticity window open, you know, if I'd started using them as early as I used a fork, if they feel more like an extension of my hand, just kind of this perfectly intuitive part of my body.
Well, we could easily come back to a lot of this. There's a lot of food left on the table, if you will. Because indeed, like how, if you start early with chopsticks, are you in fact more skilled with them? And then there's the question of, you know, why isn't chopsticks usage part of one's DNA? Like how long does something have to be around in human culture before it is part of our human genetic legacy? And then to what extent does cultural knowledge make genetic information less important?
Oh, well, you can certainly make that argument. I mean, a big thing about what culture is that culture is a great substitute for instinct.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need quite so many inborn instincts that are hardwired into the brain if you have children who are born as learning machines and adults who can teach them what to do.
Yeah, a lesson is learned by the individual in months, whereas it would be learned by the species across, a million years.
Yeah. And I like that about us. I like that it's fun being a human because you can grow up learning to use fork and knife or you can grow up learning to use chopsticks. The brain works either way. If we were some kind of lizard that just had like a hardwired fork and knife nervous system and chopsticks would never make sense to us, that would be a tragedy.
It would. It would. It would be a world without all of these fabulous inventions, including chopsticks. All right. So there you have it. An introduction to the history of chopsticks, to the use of chopsticks, and then the way it changes the way we interact with our food, think about food, etc. If you would like to check out more episodes of this podcast, head on over to inventions.show.uk.edu, and you'll find all the episodes of Invention that we have unleashed thus far.
Big thanks to our audio producer, Bruce Dickinson.
Invention is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.